Out of the gun, Josh Allen fires it quickly. Caught at the 14-yard line by Diggs. Diggs inside the five, headed to the end zone. He is in. Touchdown, Buffalo. Stephon Diggs, touchdown.
That was Bills quarterback Josh Allen connecting with Stephon Diggs for a touchdown, sending Pittsburgh packing with their second loss in a row. As the path to the NFL playoffs narrows, we saw the Chiefs fight off Tua's comeback in Miami, and Jalen Hurts helped the Eagles take flight in Philly. So NFL insider Bill Barnwell tells us what he saw in the numbers behind the stories. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, December 14th. This is ESPN Daily. 3, 2, 1. Bill Barnwell, we just watched the now 10-3 Bills beat the now 11-2 Steelers 26-15. And I am not certain of many things in this world anymore, but I am pretty certain there are going to be a lot of babies named Josh born in Buffalo next year.
Let alone the people in Buffalo who are named EJ, Drew, Rob, Doug, Tyrod, who are all going to have to change their name to Josh over the next few months.
Bill Barnwell hosts the Bill Barnwell Show podcast, and you can find his indispensable NFL column on ESPN Plus every Monday. He's also never broken a table that we know of. Bill, help me understand this. How did the Buffalo Bills turn things around after such a slow start on offense tonight?
This was interesting because the Steelers kind of got out to the sort of exact start you would want, right? I mean, Josh Allen was struggling. The Steelers' pass rush was in his face early and often. Josh Allen started this game 7 of 16 for 39 yards with an interception and a fumble.
Allen in the gun. He's back. Late rush, throws it down the left sideline, and it's intercepted. And that is a great
job. The Pittsburgh offense was struggling on the other side of the ball, it's fair to say, but it looked like the Steelers were in Josh Allen's head. And maybe last year, that would have been it. Josh Allen never would have recovered. This year is different. Josh Allen is different, and he has a weapon nobody can cover. And the combination of Allen and Stephon Diggs took advantage of some rare mistakes and misplays from the Pittsburgh Steelers. Allen's hot stretch started really when the Steelers tried to tackle Diggs on a 3rd-and-3 without their hands, which is hard. Allen took that play upfield for 23 yards, and then he got going. Diggs had 2 catches on plays where Steelers defensive backs just fell down, including a touchdown. And then Allen made 1 great throw against 2 deep coverage for a touchdown pass to Gabriel Davis.
Cox's arm fires into the end zone. Caught. Touchdown, Buffalo. Touchdown, Bills. Gabriel Davis caught that one. A 13-yard strike.
And a 2nd throw on the run to force a long pass interference penalty to Dawson Knox. It seemed like the Steelers might have figured out the third-year quarterback. But by the 2nd half, it was pretty clear things were the other way around.
So looking at the Steelers now, Bill, I am curious what exactly has been solved with them, because this is a team that went from undefeated not so long ago to losing 2 in a row now to Washington and Buffalo. So based on what you've seen these last 2 weeks, how worried should Pittsburgh actually be?
I think there's reasons for legitimate concern here. I mean, the defense wasn't the problem. At the end of the day, they allowed the Bills to score 19 points. So I'm not stressed about the defense on the whole. They've had some injuries. So that's going to be a legitimate concern, but this is still a very good defense. And they are prohibitive favorites still to win the AFC North. But I think even before the last 2 games, the last 2 losses, there were concerns about this offense. The Steelers came into this game ranked 30th in rushing offense DVOA, the Football Outsiders efficiency statistic. Ben Roethlisberger was 29th in the league in completion percentage on deep passes. He'd become a very erratic deep passer. And the Steelers basically have been left with an offense that almost exclusively consists of short passes, trying to get the ball out of Roethlisberger's hands quickly. That's helped keep him healthy, which is great, but that offense has 1 explosive game since the start of November, and Sunday night was not the 2nd. We saw the offense struggle in the exact same ways. Even though they got James Conner, their starting running back in the lineup, they lost multiple starting offensive linemen to injuries and ran the ball 17 times for 47 yards. And when Roethlisberger tried to throw deep, he was 1 of 5 for 19 yards with a touchdown and a pick. Now, it's possible the Steelers are tired after basically going 14 weeks without a real bye. They've had their 2 bye weeks, of course, basically taken away due to COVID concerns. Remember, the one saving grace all year for the Steelers as they were going undefeated was the possibility of getting that week off as the number one seed in the AFC. Now, they've fallen behind the Chiefs with losses in their past two games. The upshot only gives Steelers an 8% chance of coming away with the number one seed in the conference. And as we talked about last week, that's the only way to get a bye in the playoffs at this point. The stakes have been raised for the Steelers. I'm not sure whether they're up to the challenge.
And it feels like it is only clearer that the measuring stick against which all contenders are evaluated has to be Kansas City. And the Chiefs, Bill, they seem to find themselves in some amount of danger on Sunday, only to escape narrowly against the Dolphins and their young quarterback, Tua Tagovailoa. So after watching Patrick Mahomes ultimately win this game, 33-27, how did Miami put this big a scare into the now 12-1 Chiefs?
So, Pablo, they did something that nobody has been able to do to the Chiefs all season. That's forced takeaways. Patrick Mahomes hasn't made as many spectacular plays maybe this year as he did during that MVP season, his first starting year in 2018, but they've been really effective at avoiding takeaways. They haven't had more than one takeaway in any one given game until this Dolphins game. Against the Dolphins, Mahomes threw two early interceptions to help the Dolphins get out to a 10-0 lead.
Back to throw, play action fake, looking, dumps it down, intercepted, ball tipped and picked. Second interception of the day of Patrick Mahomes.
And while the Chiefs ran off 30 consecutive points to go ahead, the Dolphins stripped Mecole Hardman inside the red zone to stop one possession in the second half, and then Xavien Howard picked off Mahomes in the end zone for Kansas City's fourth turnover of the game. Now, I don't know if that's a sustainable formula for opposing teams, given that they went from one turnover as a maximum to four, but they were able to get back into the game and give the Chiefs a genuine battle by forcing those takeaways from an offense that just hasn't done that really all season.
So Tua did look really promising at times, Bill, I thought, passing for 316 yards. So how did the Chiefs keep that fourth quarter comeback that Miami attempted from becoming anything more than that?
Yeah, I mean, Tua made a bunch of plays in this game, and I thought he was overall very good, but the Chiefs were able to keep that lead by stopping the Dolphins from hitting on their really deep pass attempts. So traveling 30 or more yards downfield, Tua was 0 of 2 in this game for an interception and a dropped interception. He's 0 for 9 on those passes so far as a pro. And when you look at the Chiefs and you try to figure out how anyone might beat the Chiefs, the only team that's beaten this year are the Las Vegas Raiders. In that game, Las Vegas hit 3 passes, traveling 30 yards or more downfield. Now, over the rest of the entire season, the Chiefs have allowed one of those passes across their other 12 games. So when you play the Chiefs, you can't dink and dunk. You have to fight fire with fire. And the Dolphins did a lot right on Sunday. They got close, but because they weren't able to hit those big plays, they were not able to get over the hump and beat the best team in the AFC.
So you mentioned the Raiders, and I want to turn to them now because they went from barely escaping the Jets infamously last week to getting blown all the way out by the Colts on Sunday, 44-27, Bill. And after the game, as if the indignities were not enough, they fired their defensive coordinator, Paul Gunther. And now, after having playoff and even Super Bowl aspirations coming into the season, they seem to be really out of luck. So what has happened to the Las Vegas Raiders?
Yeah, firing Paul Gunther on a short week in advance of Thursday, that's really out of character for an NFL team. And at the same time, though, it's not really a surprise. I mean, the Raiders fired Gunther because this defense hasn't gotten much better since John Gruden took over in 2018. The Raiders ranked 31st in DVOA in each of Gruden's first 2 years with the team, where Gunther was the defensive coordinator. And then despite heavy investments on that side of the ball, they were only up to 24th before getting blown off the field by the Colts on Sunday. Free agents like LaMarcus Joyner and Corey Littleton have gotten significantly worse after arriving in town, and their first-round picks haven't done much better. Clelin Ferrell had 2 sacks against the Jets, which is great, and no sacks against anybody else this year. They took advantage of safety Jonathan Abram, not only on a couple of passing plays, but also on a long Jonathan Taylor touchdown run.
They'll sweep it right side of Jonathan Taylor. Huge hole. 45, 50, 45, 40 down the far sideline. Outsprinting everybody. 10, 5, Jonathan Taylor. Touchdown.
Gruden's offense has been pretty good, but the defense leaves them with no margin for error. And we know that by looking at how they do with relation to the turnover margin. Now, every team does better when they win the turnover battle. That's not exactly some new stat or anything, but the Raiders are an extreme example. Under Gruden, since he got there in 2018, they've gone 18-9 now when they win or tie the turnover battle. When they have more giveaways than takeaways, though, they're now 0-18, including a -3 mark yesterday. They're within one Hail Mary against the Jets of losing four straight and falling entirely out of the playoff picture.
So let's look ahead to the remainder of the AFC's playoff picture, Bill, because Monday Night Football has the Ravens visiting the Browns in a really consequential iteration of this AFC North rivalry. And last week, we talked about how Baker Mayfield's big game against the Titans was not necessarily the norm for him at that point. So how big a test is this rematch between the Ravens and the Browns going to be?
For whatever conversations people are having about Baker Mayfield publicly on social media or on TV, I don't think anybody who actually watched the film from that Tennessee game closely has any real change in their opinion about Baker Mayfield. That was just the dream matchup of a bad defense that wasn't pressuring him, giving him huge opportunities for plays. This is going to be different. The Ravens are a different caliber of defense from what we saw in Tennessee. I think the problem for Mayfield in the first game these two teams played, and the key to avoid for the Browns tonight, is falling behind early. In the first game, Mayfield was intercepted on the first drive of the season. The Browns failed on a fake punt at the end of the second drive. By halftime, they were down 24-6, and there was no coming back. Some quarterbacks are great when they're throwing from behind. Mayfield is not one of them. When the Browns have trailed by 14 points or more this year, Mayfield's QBR is 21.8. That's ranked 29th in the NFL among starting quarterbacks. In every other situation, he ranks 8th in QBR. He's a much better player when he has a lead or when the game is close. He dominated the Titans last week off of play action. If Mayfield can do the same thing on Monday against a much better defense, it's much more likely to give him pressure problems. He's going to gain way more believers when it comes to people within the NFL.
All right, Bill, up next, I want us to move from the AFC over to the NFC, and I want to find out if Jalen Hurts' long-awaited first start with the Eagles has made you a believer in him.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each one-ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
So, Bill, after weeks of just watching Carson Wentz struggle abjectly, the Eagles lost 4 in a row, and we finally got to watch Jalen Hurts start his first NFL game on Sunday against this terrifying Saints defense. And New Orleans is 10-2. They're excellent. But Philly jumped out to a 17-0 lead. They hung on to win 24-21. So how would you grade Jalen Hurts in his debut for the now 4-8-1 Philadelphia Eagles?
Oh, I'm a tough grader, Pablo. I have to be honest, but I would give him a B minus. And I think kind of if you were Doug Peterson and the Eagles, this went the way you would have hoped, and even beyond the victory. The idea would have been heading into this game that the Eagles would be able to sort of leverage the same ideas and the same concepts the Saints have with Taysom Hill, where he really gave the Saints fits was as a scrambler. He ran 4 times for 50 yards and 4 first downs as a scrambler off of pass plays on Sunday. The Saints hadn't allowed a 100-yard rusher since 2017, an NFL record in terms of the Super Bowl era for longest time without allowing a 100-yard rusher. But the Saints allowed two different Eagles to hit 100 yards on Sunday. Not only Jalen Hurts, but Miles Sanders also topped 100 yards off of a 82-yard touchdown run in the first half of this game.
And Sanders breaking free. He's at the 40, 50, 40, 30, 20, 10, 5, touchdown!
Miles now, Sanders wasn't all roses. Hurts failed on a 4th-and-1. He had a absolutely unacceptable late fumble to get the Saints back in the game, but he was still better protecting the football than Wentz has been this year. He only averaged 5.6 yards per pass attempt, but Hurts wasn't sacked once on 30 dropbacks, which is a huge achievement given how frequently Carson Wentz was getting sacked. And Hurts fired off a perfect back shoulder throw to Alshon Jeffrey for an early touchdown in this game.
There's Hurts. He's back. He is floating the football. It is caught. Touchdown. Touchdown. He gets it over to Alshon Jeffrey. Boy,
he showed. And by the way, Pablo, just want to throw this out there. Just a little stat to bring up. The Eagles are 35-33-1 with Carson Wentz as their starting quarterback. They are now 11-3 with anybody else besides Carson Wentz as their starting quarterback under Doug Peterson. So I do think everything points to Jalen Hurts getting a second start next week.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I love that you're a harsh grader. That's how I was raised. I want to adopt that policy for ESPN Daily, all of which leads me to shudder on behalf of Taysom Hill, because that's what was going on the other side of the field. The great Taysom Hill experiment rolling on for New Orleans with Drew Brees still tending to those, let's count them up, 11 fractured ribs, which will probably keep him out of the Chiefs game next week, it's looking like. So where are we with Taysom Hill, Bill, at this point? What'd you see from him under center in this game?
So, Pablo, Taysom Hill is like the worst possible quarterback for Twitter. Because on Twitter, you want to do one of two things watching football. You either want to make a long-term proclamation for the next 10 years about somebody based on one play, or dunk on people for being wrong about that person up to that point. And again, that happens 10 or 15 times throughout a game for each individual player. It's exhausting, and it doesn't work for Taysom Hill because he looks totally inconsistent from week to week, or for even from drive to drive. You can put together a 10-play highlight reel where he looks absolutely incredible, and a 10-play reel where he looks like a maybe more mobile Nathan Peterman. I mean, even in this game alone, Pablo, he was two different quarterbacks. In the first half, the Saints were sloppy on offense. They were dropping passes. Hill threw a pass off Alvin Kamara's hands for a pick. He was 11 of 15, which is okay, but only for 65 yards. It's not going to get the job done. They were shut out heading into halftime. After the break, different guy, much improved. And in part, I think that's not only because of Hill, but even because of the Eagles. They lost three of their four starting defensive backs. They were a mess making tackles. The Saints picked up a ton of yards after catch. Taysom Hill took advantage of one of those backup cornerbacks to hit Emmanuel Sanders for a long touchdown, and he worked the middle of the field for steady gains. Here's what I think it comes down to after these four games. Hill, I think he's done enough for the Saints to stick with him next week against the Chiefs, especially given that Drew Brees is probably not going to be 100%. But once Brees is healthy, I don't think Taysom Hill is going to be keeping him out of the lineup.
Maybe the most startling performance on Sunday came from Mitch Trubisky, because the Bears quarterback throws three touchdowns to beat the Texans, which ultimately keeps Chicago in the NFC playoff hunt and ends up begging this larger question, which I want to ask you, because after controlling for expectation level, how impressed should we be by Trubisky in a game like today's? Does this change anything about his viability as the Bears starter going forward?
No, unfortunately not. I don't want to be too harsh because, let's be fair, I think everybody was coming into this game expecting Deshaun Watson to just stomp the Bears and make them feel really foolish for drafting Mitchell Trubisky ahead of him with the second overall pick in 2017. That didn't happen. Bears defense played very well, and Mitch Trubisky did hold up his end of the bargain. I will say, I do think he was mostly taking advantage of a Texans defense, which is basically signed off and is more interested in what's going to happen in 2021. So the Texans really made it easy for Trubisky. And even though he took advantage, I think that he didn't really do all that much to exploit those opportunities. Really, this game on the whole felt like last week, where we talked about the Jets fans, who, even though they were about to beat the Raiders and end their winless streak, those Jets fans were more worried about the possibility of missing out on Trevor Lawrence. The Bears fans I know watching this game were not excited about Trubisky. They were more worried that an organization that's been fooled by Trubisky before might have gotten tricked by what they saw yesterday and actually somehow fallen for Trubisky all over again and might give him a chance to start again in 2021. Honestly, I don't fault Trubisky. I don't think he played poorly, but I don't think anything should change with the long-term plan for the Chicago Bears based on what we saw in Sunday's blowout win over Houston.
Bill, I want to dive into what happened in this Vikings game now, because it was a loss to the Buccaneers, 26-14. Yes, that is all true. But what stuck out most was just the sad, sad ballad of Minnesota kicker Dan Bailey. And he's not one, not two, not three, but four missed kicks. So, Bill, explain to me what happened here.
I feel bad. I just feel bad saying this.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's what happened. I think this is a fault in part from Bailey, but really more from the Minnesota organization. This is how NFL teams fool themselves into thinking they're smarter than they actually are. It's a lot like the Twitter situation. The Vikings signed Bailey in 2018. He has kind of a rough season. In 2019, Vikings coach Mike Zimmer is frustrated by Bailey in training camp. The Vikings trade a fifth-round pick to the Ravens for their backup kicker, Kyrie Vedvik. At the end of camp, a month later, they've changed their mind. They cut Vedvik. They stick with Bailey. So, of course, as you know, Bailey was struggling all year, and he was a mess last week. The Vikings probably would have cut Bailey under normal circumstances in a typical year, but as Lindsey Jones of The Athletic noted on Twitter, the NFL's COVID policies mean that teams have to wait 6 days before a player who wants to try out can even go through that tryout and join the team for practice. So the Vikings gave Bailey one more shot, and he missed an extra point and two field goals in the first half alone.
All of which, by the way, all of which is so devastating on its own for a kicker.
You can only imagine how bad Dan Bailey felt about this at halftime. And then what happened in the second half might have been my favorite moment of week 14, because it was just all this tension built up. So the Vikings had clearly given up on Bailey. They were going for it on fourth down, even in situations where teams don't typically go for it on fourth down just to avoid Bailey. So Vikings are moving the ball. Things go south. They have a first and goal on the 8-yard line. There's an incompletion, and then Kirk Cousins is sacked twice in a row. So instead of having first and goal on the 8-yard line, they had fourth and goal from the 28-yard line. Every coach in the NFL is kicking a field goal in this situation under any circumstance. No one else is even considering the possibility of going for it. And so you know Mike Zimmer, who wanted nothing to do with Dan Bailey, could not have possibly wanted to kick a field goal in this situation. You know he wanted to go for it. And yet he knew, by the arbitrary rules of football, he had no choice. He had to respect the football gods by kicking a field goal in that situation. He sent Bailey out for what was probably his final kick with the Vikings. And of course, Bailey missed it.
Snap spot. Dan Bailey missed it to the right. He's 0-3 on field goals.
Wow.
He's missed all four kicks today.
Bill Barnwell, thank you for always being automatic on ESPN Daily.
Thank you, Papa.
All right, coming up. On Saturday, Florida's Keontae Johnson fell to the court, and the scene felt all too familiar.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine. Especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Here's another story I want you to know. Keontae Johnson collapsed on Saturday, and I couldn't bring myself to watch the video a second time. The video isn't just disturbing, and it is truly disturbing. It feels invasive.
The University of Florida's star forward was coming out of a first half timeout when he suddenly lost consciousness, falling to the ground face first, right onto the half-court logo of Florida State. And as Keontae Johnson is just lying there, you're left to watch his teammates process this waking nightmare just as suddenly, panicking, crying into towels, holding their heads, terrified that their friend Keontae, at age 21, had just died in front of them. And for anyone old enough, the entire scene was haunting for an additional reason. It eerily echoed another infamous sequence from March 1990, when Hank Gathers, Loyola Marymount's 6'7" All-American, collapsed mid-game, right after throwing down an alley-oop dunk with two hands. Gathers would be pronounced dead at a nearby hospital, the victim of a fatal heart condition at age 23. At 6'5", Keontae Johnson is a gifted, high-flying prospect, too. The junior was voted the SEC's preseason player of the year. He was projected to be a first-round draft pick. And on the play right before Johnson collapsed, he threw down an alley-oop dunk with two hands, just like Gathers. They stopped the game Saturday to rush Johnson to a nearby hospital in Tallahassee. At last check, per ESPN's Myron Medcalf, Johnson remains in critical but stable condition, with so many questions left unanswered. One of them stems from the fact that Johnson, like most of the Florida basketball team, had contracted COVID-19 earlier this year. And the virus, it bears mentioning here, can lead to myocarditis, a potentially fatal infection of the heart. Now, to be clear, we still don't know anything definitive about how or if Johnson's condition connects to the pandemic that has plagued this endless year. But on Saturday, I heard another kind of eerie echo, a sound bouncing across the court where Keontae Johnson had just collapsed. Because minutes after the players had all huddled up in prayer, officials asked the University of Florida what they wanted to do next. And unlike 30 years ago, on the last day of the life of Hank Gathers, a decision was made by both teams that might have been shocking in any other year but 2020. They decided to keep playing. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.